Welcome, Progressive Radio Network listeners, green future growers, and anyone who's new to the show.
Welcome to the Organic Gardener Podcast today. It's still Friday, February 23rd, 2018. And actually, this episode might come right out quickly because we're talking about a Kickstarter campaign that's live. So it might bump to the front of the line this week if it can. And I have an amazing guest with me. He has this really cool business called Ecologia Design. He emphasizes, or his focus is in edible and ecological landscapes. He's going to talk to us about not just his book, Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist, How to Have Your Yard and Eat It Too, but he's also going to tell us about this really cool tree called a pawpaw tree and the pawpaw fruit that grows in North America. And so here today to talk to us is Michael Judd.
Welcome, hi, everybody. Michael. Thank you, Jackie.
Well, I'm done. Go ahead and tell listeners about yourself, and I'm going to try to be quiet because we've actually, our pre-chat's been going for like 20 minutes, and I basically haven't shut up. So I'm going to let you guys learn all about Michael.
Okay. I live in Maryland. We live on a permaculture homestead. Permaculture means that it's ecologically designed. So I'm sitting in my circular straw bale home. With a living roof and earthen floors. As I look out my windows, I'm looking at raised beds that are called hugelkultur beds, which are basically wood covered with soil that are slowly breaking down, that I'll begin planting my perennial fruits and berries into after a couple of years. I'm looking at a living willow dome. So I create these living willow structures that are great for gathering or playing in.
I'll bet they're great for shade. Do willows grow where I live?
Sure. Yeah, they do. Willows are hardy to cold weather. They're really quite resilient and they're fast growing.
That sounds so fun.
Yeah, the willow temples, and I usually start with, 8 foot long live willow rods that I get from Vermont Willow. They've got a wonderful website, very inexpensive to start. Now, what I do is I build a rebar frame first, and then I plant the willow rods at the base of each rebar, and I just create this willow dome structure room that does create shade within like 2 or 3 years. It fills in and becomes this magical place. So, I like to play with the ecological, the edible, mix it all up in the art. Make it look good and be productive. That's why I say you can have your yard and eat it too. It doesn't have to be this humdrum, little garden plot at the back of the yard. It can really be creatively mixed into, a very beautiful landscape. It can be front yard. I have clients that are in, very high-end HOAs. I do urban restaurant designs. And they're very functional and they're very productive. We're talking lots of food being produced and looking really beautiful.
This is awesome. I remember looking through your website and just because Mike's always wanted to build a straw bale house. And so we're really interested in that. And then one of my very first guests, like episode 8 or something, was with this woman, LaDonna Kinnick. And she talked about hugelkultur. And I was like, what the heck are you talking about? But you make it look gorgeous. And then the other thing that you do are those herb spirals, which Mike had showed me, last summer or the summer before. And was like, we should build one of these. But we didn't get it done, but he wants to build one outside my kitchen window. But great. Before we go any further, I do always like to start the show asking about your very first gardening experience. Like, were you a kid? Were you an adult? Did your parents garden? Like, who were you with? What'd you grow?
We had a small garden in the back of our yard. And one of my first memories is cutting asparagus. And that experience really stayed with me. Just something about being able to go out there and cut something growing out of the ground and eating it gave me a connection that stayed with me. And then I really got into working with, the land and growing. When I lived with the last of the Lacandon Mayans down in Chiapas, and the last bit of jungle that stretches between southern Mexico and Guatemala, I got an experience to live with one of the tribes there about 20 years ago. And I got to see and experience how we as humans can actually live off of the land and with the land regeneratively. you know, generation after generation after generation. So it really brought home to me that this is possible. And that really has shaped my life and everything that I do now. It's core to the center of my belief that a lot of these approaches can and will work.
I love all of that. How lucky to go down by Mexico and by Guatemala. That sounds really cool.
It's another world.
But now you're in Maryland.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, now we have, we live on about 25 acres up in the foothills of the Blue Ridge Mountains. These are Appalachian Mountains, some of the oldest on the planet. And we have a creek that runs through our property. So I guess this is a bona fide Appalachian holler. And it is a wonderful growing climate. We are about 6B7. We have wonderful humidity in our summer. I mean, it's basically tropical here in the summertime, and things just grow like crazy. And then we do have winter. It gets cold, but it's not extensive. It really is one of the sweetest spots, growing spots that I know of. So very happy here.
I love all of that. Especially, we read a book about Appalachia with the kids this fall. And also, one of my favorite guests but she's from Kentucky, so maybe she's like on the other side.
Well, that's they tail down there.
Yeah, was Joyce Pinson, and she's the one who taught me about G. Martin Fortier and the Market Farmer. And so that place is kind of getting a special place in my heart. So then, is that how you learned how to garden organically there?
Well, my journey has been all around the world. It really started living in Latin America. And then I lived in southeastern Spain and Almeria, which is now a desert. It's where the old spaghetti westerns were shot. And there I worked with an English charity that was living in like an abandoned village in a crack in the desert that was an oasis. Underground stream popped out at the top of this crack and ran a mile through it and then disappeared again. And the Moors 1,000 years ago carved flood irrigation ditches at the very top of the crack and created terrace and flood irrigation all the way down. So literally this oasis in the desert, in this crack in the desert. So I lived there and worked on all of these terraces, these ancient terraces, and did arid lands research. For similar type climates in Africa and other places. I've done biodynamic farming out in Colorado. I've done a lot of permaculture and natural building, a lot of it natural building out in Santa Fe and New Mexico. My journey's been rich.
I'll say.
Now here, my living and my life is working with the land and helping other people, you know, reconnect with growing food in ways that are functional and easy and rewarding, and not sort of Victorian, which seems to have this impression that if you're not working hard, you're not doing it right. And really a little bit of design up front, you know, really harvesting your rainwater, you know, creating microclimates, you know, mulching well, using wood chips, you know, using these natural flows. If you set that up first, if you set kind of the bones up, the structure, then whatever you plant will thrive. It really is a very successful way to go, rather than just kind of, you know, run out there and start planting something. Learn just a little bit of design up front. And my first book, Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist, really simplifies these approaches, breaks it down into projects. So you mentioned the herb spiral. That's like the first chapter of my book. And you don't have to understand the dynamics of permaculture or even edible landscaping to sort of say, wow, I like that. And look, here's how it's done. And if you know, if you went to kindergarten, you can build an herb spiral. It really is quite straightforward. And I think that's you start off and you have success. It encourages you. Then maybe you start another project. And each chapter is a different project. You know, like my second chapter is on, you know, how do you create, you know, swales, raised beds on contour that passively harvest rainwater so that you're harvesting rainwater into your landscape every time it rains. which makes a huge difference in its productivity. So, I mean, but, you know, you don't have to initially understand all the complexities of that. You just see how it's done, and then you can go out and you do it, and then you begin to live the experience and the dynamics of it.
That's so cool. You've been dropping golden seeds like crazy. I feel like I've already learned a ton in just like every paragraph that I've been typing and you've been seeing. This is amazing. Because I've been hearing about those swales, like I said, for 3 years now, since she mentioned that. But I never understood any of that. I was like, what the heck are these people building? What's the point of the swale anyway? I was completely like, huh?
Well, okay. I can break that down a little bit more. It's digging a basin and putting that soil that you dig out of your basin on the downhill side, and that creates a berm, that creates a raised bed. I then go ahead and fill that dugout basin with wood chips, and you can use that as a walking path next to your raised berm. And then as water comes down the landscape and it falls into that basin, since it's on contour, which means it's not pushing water one way or the other, it stops and it seeps into the ground and it recharges the water table, not just for that berm, but 30, 40 feet down slope, it has rehydrated your entire landscape. And then if you mulch that well, even during drought, things thrive.
Man, you think you would be like, everybody would be buying your book to learn this stuff? Because how many drought places, like, why aren't you on the news instead of like all the garbage they hear on the news? Because this is important stuff. Instead of having all these wildfires, maybe we could have things a little more protected. And I don't know.
It's not complicated, really. It's not.
Plus, you're making it sound doable and simple and like not anywhere. You're making it sound a lot less intimidating than it looks on your pictures, because your pictures are very professional looking and just stunning, like that spiral with the cool shadows. Like that thing looks like you worked for hours to get that picture like that.
No, they're beautiful on their own. It's easy. It makes taking pictures easy.
And then I'm such a big, like the whole herb spiral thing. Like I love that idea because I love herbs. There's a lot of reasons why I like to grow herbs, because they're generally pretty hardy, pretty easy. The birds and the bees love them. So if you don't harvest them, you're not feeling guilty. And you probably are going to harvest them because they give so much bang to your food. And I don't know. They come back generally every year. Most herbs, you don't have to replant. And there's just a lot of things I like about herbs for beginners. And then the whole spiral thing, it's just really cool looking besides.
Yeah, I call the herb spiral edible architecture because it's beautiful year round. Even in the wintertime when most things are kind of down and flat, you've got this beautiful garden architecture. You know, it does remind you that things are going to grow again. And also creates a lot more growing space for the footprint. You can get up to 9 times the growing space for the diameter of the footprint. So that's really critical for people with tight spaces. And you can put them over almost anything. You can put them over a super wet spot. You can put them over your driveway. I mean, they're very versatile in where they can go. And you can build them really big, and you can make them your garden spiral, not just herbs. You know, for some of my clients that live in, you know, small urban yards with one little zone, one little area that has sunshine, you know, and they want a garden, I'll build a large spiral and that will now be their garden.
Interesting. How come they can have so much more space per diameter? Well, what'd you call it? For the footprint?
For the footprint, you know, it's spiraling up, you know, it's kind of like the idea of the skyscraper in a way where you're getting more space because you're going vertical. It's taking vertical space instead of horizontal space in your yard.
I know, but you can't like plant one plant on top of the other. Like in a skyscraper, you can have two offices on top of each other, but you can't really put a plant on top of each other.
Well, as it spirals, you're creating sort of more surface as it goes. It runs all the way up. You're just creating more, you know, more inches to plant into. And I'll also throw out there that they also create a bit of a microclimate because of all the stone. It helps overwinter things that might be really on the cusp for not overwintering. You know, a lot of times we'll lose rosemary over the winter here.
I was just going to ask you, do you have any tips for rosemary?
Build an herb spiral or put a lot of masonry around it, whether that's stone or brick. That will collect and radiate heat and help buffer, you know, the cold. It'll help things start early in the spring, go later into the season in the fall, and a lot of times will even help things over winter.
Cool. Oh, this is awesome. I'm trying not to say I love that as much because I've been listening to my show and I realize I say I love that all the time, even though I really do love that. But I'm trying to come up with some new things to say. How about, do you want to tell us about something that grew well this year?
Last season? Lots of things are growing well. The Willow Temple certainly is going bonkers. Pawpaws. I grow a lot of pawpaws. Pawpaw trees grow very well.
Well, tell people what a pawpaw is, because they're probably like, and let's even spell it for them.
Okay, pawpaw, P-A-W-P-A-W, is a relative of the custard apple from the tropics in the cherimoya and the soursop, you know, all subtropical, tropical species. So when the glaciers receded millennia ago, the pawpaw slowly migrated from the warmer climes down south all the way back up into, you know, native range of 26 states in the U.S., you know, all the way up into Pennsylvania, Nebraska. So it basically slowly migrated to where we have a tropical fruit tree that grows in the north. And it looks like it. It has these huge, beautiful leaves. And then it produces, when it has sunshine, a fruit that can be the size of a mango, and inside have this beautiful cream-colored, custardy flesh with flavors of mango and banana and pineapple. So it's an exquisitely beautiful tree. When it's in full sun, it grows into a pyramid shape, 15 to 20 feet tall, not bothered by insects or disease. And if you have the right cultivar and the right conditions, you can get like 50 pounds of fruit per tree. So it's super abundant, super tasty, and super beautiful.
And super, yeah, they're super cool looking. Okay, so pawpaws grew well this year. What about the willow temples? Yeah. I don't remember seeing a willow temple on your website when I looked there.
No,
like, where's a picture of a willow temple?
I need to, you know, get a post up about that. Because, you know, I also do willow tunnels. Really, it's just taking the growing willow and weaving it. It's such an abundant grower and it's so flexible that you can literally just begin to weave it into itself. You can even make bridges. You can make living bridges out of willow by planting on either bank. And then as they grow up, bring them down, tie them together. And if you keep working with the growth and you keep sort of tying it and weaving it together, it begins to thicken and become this solid, you know, form that you create or you co-create with the willow. It's very exciting. I'm wanting to reach out into the schools, especially in the urban areas where children don't have a lot of access to the experience of nature, and build these so that, because when you go inside of a willow temple, a willow dome, I should say, you feel like you're in the canopy of a tree. It's a very magical space, you know, for children, for adults, and they're quite large. Like the one I have out here is at least 16 feet in diameter. So you could easily fit, you know, 20 people in there comfortably. You know, to have a talk or a workshop or just to hang out. They are phenomenal. And if you Google, you know, living willow dome, you'll see a lot of cool things that can be done with living willows.
You know, last year, my kids, so when I was teaching second grade last year, my classroom was kind of on the end of this one hallway and we had to go pick our kids up in the gym. And instead of like, so there's 360 kids in the school and we're all picking our kids up at the same time. And instead of walking through the cluster of kids in the hallway, which gives me like claustrophobic phobia, like it just gave me the willies, I would actually take my class outside on the sidewalk and walk all the way around the front of the school. And we would come in the back door by my classroom. And there was this giant tree the kids would walk by and we would call it Grandfather Tree. And I would say, okay, you can go give the tree a hug.
They loved to be under that tree. It was this giant fir tree. And for the kids, it was the perfect size. And I always promised we never did have a picnic out there, but we were always going to have a picnic out there under that tree. There's nothing better than being like in a little magical dome under a tree. And I can remember being a kid under, my parents had a blue spruce tree, and my brother and I spent hours playing under that little thing. You are so right. This is so cool.
Yeah. Well, you know, it reminds me of your question about what was my first garden experience. Not everybody's into gardening or even going to have that opportunity, but you know, if we can get some of these living structure experiences into schools, into where children can just have that moment, that insight into the magic of nature and life, that can touch their lives and open up possibilities that they never realized were there.
Oh my gosh. So true. Who was, someone was just telling me about this guy. Well, somebody recommended this book, and then I wrote to the author, and he like wrote a book about the nature and the child or something about getting kids outdoors. I'm going to try to have him on. His last name I want to say is Louvre, like Louvre or something. Louvre. But it's so true that kids need that connection, and that connection can really in one day change a life in just one day in their early elementary years. And then I always tell my listeners, like, if you're a parent, don't get discouraged, or grandparent, if your kids don't want to be in the woods with you, because so many of my guests have been like, or in the garden with you, have been like, I didn't want to have anything to do with the garden. And I didn't want to have anything to do with the garden when I was a kid. I love nature though, being outdoors. And it crushes me. Like, I live in Montana. How many students in the different schools I've worked in, not even where I am, but in all the different schools I've worked in here, where the kids don't live, where the deer live in their yard. What's the point of living in Montana if you don't have deer in your yard? Like, we have deer in the yard all the time, but I don't know how many kids I've taught that hardly ever see a deer.
Yeah.
It's just crazy. And so getting kids in nature is so important.
That's key.
Sorry to go on that little tangent. This is why my listeners are always like, Jackie, be quiet and quit interrupting your guests. How about, is there something new or different you're excited to try next time or next year, or this year coming up?
I am going to work more with the Cornelian cherry, which is a fruiting dogwood. So it's a dogwood that has quite a delectable fruit. The Latin for it is Cornus mas. And it is not the causa. There's a causa dogwood that has sort of that knobby red fruit, which is edible but full of lots of seeds. This is not that. This is a Cornelian cherry. It has a very sort of plump, juicy, sweet, tart fruit that's very, very popular in Europe and grows well and into quite cold climates as well. Very ornamental too. So it's hitting on these what I call edible landscape all-stars. That have, you know, sort of beautiful form and productivity and low care. So I'm going to work more with those in this year to come. I've got a few planted, but I'm like, I need to see and move them around our landscape to see where they're happiest. You know, that goes for a couple of the characters that I'm working with, like jujube trees. I think I put them in too heavy a clay, so I need to move them over onto some of my swales where they're going to get better drainage. So, you know, I'm pleased with a lot of the things that I'm already growing. I think I just need to move them around and experiment and understand what they need more. Currants, I'm a big fan of growing black currants, especially. They're very productive. The deer really don't like them. That's a key one. The deer don't like the pawpaw tree either. That's a key one. So we have a lot of deer here too. So designing for that is always key. But the black currants really pack a lot of flavor, and they're very medicinal. So, and they're very easy to grow. So those are all important to me. You know, they value add well. They make the best jam. They make a really nice infused vodka. They just are, you get a lot of punch for the little berry that they are.
And they're probably full of antioxidants because they're a dark
loaded fruit. Loaded. You know, purple dark fruit is what's got, you know, the goods. In that same category is the aronia, which is a beautiful bush very ornamental as well. That's very productive, very medicinal. Now, it's not as great for eating fresh out of hand, but it makes it, when you cook it, it's exquisite. It's like the elderberry. When you cook it, the flavors and the sweetness come out very different than eating it raw. So I like growing elderberries, aronias, currants, gumi. Gumi is another wonderful quick growing fruit that I recommend people learning about. Very tough character too. The aronia is very tough too. Like, you know, you have a site that, you know, a place on your land that just you're having troubles with, usually planting elderberry or aronia or the gumi, you will probably have success.
Nice. Man, I keep losing my train of thought today.
I stumped you.
No, but I've heard of those aronia.
They have a terrible second name I don't like to use, but it's called chokeberry. Not chokecherry, but chokeberry. But I don't like to put that out there. I'm renaming it Wonderberry just so people are like, whoa, what's that?
Nice. I guess I was going to ask, like, so do you eat black currants that aren't cooked? Because didn't you say the aronia needed to be cooked? Not as great for eating fresh out of hand. Do you eat the black currants fresh out of hand?
Some varieties are, you know, I think it's one of these things, you know, like if you grew up in Eastern or Northern Europe, you like to eat those kind of things. It's like the English eating Marmite. You know, I think, you know, if you grew up there, then yes, you know, you can handle that. Really, they're really tart. But some people like that. I'm not one of them. You know, when you cook it, add a little bit of sugar to it. I mean, really, I'm not a big jam eater, but it makes the most exquisite jam that I've ever had. And then the French, they use it for cassis. That's, they make sort of a syrup from it that can be great added, you know, to your pancakes, to your ice cream, or to your cocktail. It really value adds nicely.
I like that. Oh my gosh, I can't believe how fast I'm like losing my train of thought today. This has been happening since my very first interview this morning. All right. Well, how about something that didn't go so well this season, like something that didn't come out the way you thought it was gonna?
Well, I think coming back to the jujubes, jujubes like it warm. They're from warmer climates. They have a smaller leaf. Often you can tell, you know, where a plant has developed by its leaf size. So out in the desert, you've got mesquites with very small leaves that deal with the drought. Then you've got things like the pawpaw with a huge leaf, which would have had to have developed in a very humid area to be able to sustain that kind of leaf. And it also developed in the understory of trees. So it, you know, it can have that large leaf structure. So the jujubes here, we're a little bit on their northern edge. They like to probably be grown, you know, more down in zone 7, zone 8, zone 9. But I feel like, you know, if I play with the conditions that I can make them work. I put them in too heavy a clay. I didn't put them in one of my swales. So I think that's one thing that I need to work on that didn't go so well, but that I feel like I can probably, you know, bring back around. Yeah.
So when you say you need to move them, this was one of the questions I was going to ask you earlier. Like, are you starting these tree type bush things out in pots and then like decide to plant them in the ground later? Or are you like actually like dig it up out of the ground? Like, how are you moving them?
Well, all of the above. A lot of times, you know, when I had to get the fresh material, I will order from mail order nurseries. I'll get things bare root. So in the past, I've gotten a lot of things from like Burnt Ridge Nursery, Rain Tree Nursery, and I'll receive them bare root and I'll plant them somewhere. And if they're not thriving after a year or two, and they're not too big, then yes, when they're dormant, I will dig them up and transplant them. I grow a lot of things in pots myself. I like to use the tree pots, the long, deep pots to grow in almost regardless of what I'm growing. You know, like 12-inch deep pots. And so, you know, I'll grow a lot of things out that way, and then I can easily plant them. But, you know, I'm I'm not afraid to be digging things up and moving them and making things, you know, finding out, learning. If something's not doing great in a spot, then, you know, dig it up, move it. You know, if there's a tree that's taking up a lot of space that's not, you know, being productive, then I'm okay with taking that tree down, cutting it down if it's too big to transplant, you know, and putting something that will do well there. You know, really just kind of keep the learning going and really, you know, maximizing the space you have to work with.
Nice. All right. And I remembered the other thing I was going to say. So I did this interview with this guy in Montana, Bob Quinn, who has, I mean, thousands of acres. He's over on the east side. He has a giant ranch. He grows a lot of Kamut wheat. But he also was talking about there's like 26 native fruits and cherries. And like his goal is that they only eat fruit and berries from their ranch in Montana and just the variety. And he has like currants and different things like that. So that's what I was just thinking about was my interview with him, because the things you're talking about sound like local native type of fruits, and that's so much better for our environment and our footprint and just being, you know, my husband and I are kind of, it's definitely more him than me in some way, I don't know, but like, you know, being as big a locavores as we can be, is getting as much local stuff, growing food closely, reducing that transportation piece.
Yeah, well, the food's more vibrant and nutritious as well. I mean, it's what's best for our bodies usually.
And I think my body craved, because like I have to like force myself to eat fruit. I mean, for one thing, as far as I'm concerned, most fruit is messy. And I got to say, those pawpaws don't look so messy. Because I don't know, I just can't stand having juice dripping down me. I ate a grapefruit at school the other day. I had to use four different napkins. How can I grade papers and eat a grapefruit at the same time when I'm driving? Same situation. And that's a grapefruit, an orange, pears sometimes are dripping down your chin, watermelon. You know, there's so many fruits to me. Fruit is just messy. But I also think like I crave vegetables and lettuce more because maybe that's what's grown where I live. I don't know. Before we get to the root of things, let's take a minute to thank our sponsors and affiliate links. The Organic Gardener Podcast is sponsored by Health IQ, an insurance company that helps health-conscious people like redners, gardeners, healthy eaters, vegetarians, and green future growers just like you get lower rates on their life insurance. Go to healthiq.com/OGP to support the show and see if you qualify. Over half of Health IQ customers save between 4 to 33% on their life insurance. These savings are exclusive to Health IQ customers because physically active people have a 56% lower risk of heart disease, a 20% lower risk of cancer, and a 58% lower risk of diabetes compared to people who are inactive. Health IQ uses science and data to secure lower rates on life insurance for health-conscious people just like you, green future growers. Like saving money on your car insurance for being a good driver, Health IQ saves you money on your life insurance for living a health-conscious lifestyle. To see if you qualify, get your free quote today at healthiq.com/OGP or mention the promo code OGP when you talk to a Health IQ agent. FreeGardenCourse.com. Mike and I have developed some lessons to help you create your very own organic oasis. We'll guide you through the steps to build your perfect natural landscape, an edible earth-friendly yard, a sustainable deep-bed garden, or even start a small profitable market farm. We'll show you how to save time, lower your produce bill, collect usable data, eat healthy, nutritious food with minimal labor, use the most effective and efficient production methods currently being used in backyard gardens as well as market farms, and maybe even help you find some profitable markets. We've designed it to save you time, lower your produce bill, and help you eat healthy, nutritious food. There's checklists, there's outside reading, video assignments. You can join the online Facebook community where there's lots of people from around the world to help you get your garden started today. So remember, freegardencourse.com. This is where we get to the part of the show I call getting to the root of things. And I'm going to ask you some quicker questions, like a lightning round. Like, do you have an activity that's like your least favorite activity that you got to kind of force yourself to go out in the garden and do?
Carrying heavy stuff. I think that's about it, because I love being outside, and I even like, you know, if weeding, which I don't do much of because I sheet mulch, you know, if there's weeds popping up, I throw down newspaper and straw and I just, you know, I let it turn into soil. You know, so no, I mean, I just don't like carrying heavy stuff and walking around with it. I guess my hips are getting old, but nope. Otherwise, I love being outside. I love working in the garden. That's where I want to be all the time.
I can totally relate. When I first came up with the question about tools, I thought a shovel, of course. But then I thought, no, it's the wheelbarrow, the thing that can move all the heavy stuff. Wheel. And even if it's bulky stuff, it's nice to have something. It doesn't even have to be heavy, but bulky stuff. But Mike moves. I mean, firewood, of course, but tons of rocks and compost and soil and plants. You know, if you're going to be taking the starts down in the wheelbarrow, you can take, you know, 3 or 4 flats in one trip instead of having to take one, you know, one in each hand trip and, you know, only one, how many trips do you have to make? Because our garden's kind of the bottom of a hill. Not that I'm sure he's in great shape because he walks the hill all the time. But anyway, I agree. Carrying heavy stuff can be a challenge. How about, although they say the best thing for people who are growing, well, any age, is strength training. I'm always in the back of my head here, John Lee Dumas say, lift heavy things, Fire Nation, lift heavy things. So I try to lift more heavy things when I can, but. What's your favorite activity to do in the garden? Then on the flip side, like, what do you love to do the most?
I love to propagate. I like to prune. I like to graft. You know, I like the sort of the intimate interactions with the perennials, I would say the most. And I mostly work with perennials. You know, I feel like I've graduated away from heavy annual agriculture just because of the, you know, the intensity and the input for the output. If you have a little bit of patience, your perennials will take care of themselves largely and then be very productive. So I just love working with my perennials.
Do you just want to dig a little deeper if listeners don't know the difference between a perennial and an annual and how that's working for you?
Well, the annuals, you know, they produce seed every year and you grow them out, you know, like your tomatoes, your corn, your squash. And then perennials live 3 or more years. A lot of the, I mean, so there can be ornamental perennials, and there's soft perennials and there's hard perennials. So a soft perennial is a perennial that will pop up. Let's say something like lemon balm, right? Or a mint. It pops up, and then in the wintertime, it dies back down and it goes flat to the ground, right? There's no woody material in it. Those are what we call soft perennials. Hard perennials, you know, form woody, you know, stems or woody trunks. So it could be the black currants, for example. That's a woody perennial. It could be an apple tree. That's a woody perennial.
Huh, interesting. I guess I didn't realize that. Oh my gosh. Okay. How about what's the best gardening advice you've ever received?
Oh, design for neglect.
Do you want to expand on that?
I like how it is kind of self-explanatory. So design for neglect. I think that, you know, even with best intentions of your time, of what you think you will be able to take care of or do on your landscape, I think it's always good to design for neglect. Design up front that you probably will not be able to manage things as best as you think you will or would like to. And so if that's the case, then things will thrive anyway. And that comes back to working with permaculture. It comes back to working with setting up the structure in your landscape, you know, digging those swales, you know, creating humiculture beds, you know, doing the herb spirals, you know, building sort of the habitat for things to thrive in. So that, like, for example, it took me 5 years to build our straw bale house. It's a circular straw bale house. It's round wood timber framed. All the wood is from our land. You know, there's a lot of hand plastering in it. It got mixed up with my life. It wouldn't have taken 5 years straight, but everything on my landscape got neglected and it thrived. So it's done well because I set up the bones. I got some design and structure in there up front. I planted things that were hardy and resistant and resilient. Design for neglect, I think, is great advice.
See, I'm glad I asked you to expand because I completely thought it meant I don't know why, but I was thinking it meant like an area that, you know, is like challenged, like a place that's really sandy that you can't deal with, or a place that's really wet, like designed for the problem that's there. But I see what you're saying. And that is so perfect for me because, as I've said several times just today, but my listeners know well, in the summer or any time of year, especially the school year, I can go 3, 4, 5 days without even seeing the garden, you know? And even in Montana where it's light out till 10, 11 o'clock at night, like that's just the way my life goes. Like yours went when you were building your house. The other thing I want to say, do you want to touch on building a straw bale house? Like, if you were starting over, what would you do different? Or like, what should we know as people who want to build a straw bale house that we probably should know, but probably don't?
Well, it's wonderful to live in. They are very organic structures in a good way, in the sense that they breathe. And I know this sounds a little esoteric, but once you live in the house, you feel that. So the straw bales always have to be able to breathe. You cannot trap moisture in a straw bale. So you can't slap, you know, siding on it or concrete, stucco. So on the inside of our straw bale, inside of our house, we have an earthen plaster, which is a really nice, it sounds rustic, but it's beautiful. Our website has some nice images of our.
Yeah, it's gorgeous. And it's round. I love that. Round.
So I love living in it. Building in the round is art, and it will take you a lot longer and it'll take a lot more time. It depends on where your life is. If you're still very busy in life, I would maybe encourage you to maybe stick with, you know, straight lines, even though I really like living in round structures. It really allows the mind to flow. It doesn't get sort of bounced back at you. It's not trapped. So psychologically, it really does something, you know, for living in. So it's very nice. Otherwise, you know, they grow in a lot of climates. As long as you've got a good roof and you have good overhangs and you have good boots, which means, you know, good boots and good hat is the saying. You have a foundation that lifts the bales off the ground, and then you have a good roof overhang so that you're not, you know, absorbing moisture into the bales. You're good to go. On the outside, we have a traditional lime stucco. So it's lime putty that is mixed with sand and applied. And when rain hits that, it sloughs off very easily. Yet, it still breathes. So it's just a wonderful feeling. And we have a living roof, so we don't absorb a lot of heat in the summer. And we have what we call sort of passive ventilation, meaning we have good low opening windows and doors, and then we have high windows where we can pull cool air in and let hot air out. So we don't need air conditioning. It feels very cool in here. All of the extra clay in the walls helps absorb excess humidity and then releases it and balances it inside the house. So even though we live in a very humid climate in the summer, it's very nice in here. It's very balanced naturally. So we're not dealing with air conditioning blowing on us or heat blowing on us in the winter. We heat the whole house with a Finnish designed masonry stove, which only takes one armful of wood at the most every 12 hours. So you put in the wood, you burn it down, and you shut it down, and it slowly radiates heat out in a very even way where you can go up and you can stick your hand on it and it'll feel warm but not hot. And it slowly emanates that heat through the whole house. And it just kind of surrounds and wraps you in this very comfortable type warmth. So again, it's the same concept of designing up front so that, you know, your inputs are very little down the road. Now, it definitely took a lot of work, you know, hands-on work to build this house, but it didn't take a lot of skill per se. So this is very approachable for people who don't have traditional building skills to really get into. Which is a really great experience for your life as well. My only recommendation is, I think, like building any home, you know, make sure that you've got some time, because it will just take over your life.
Well, I know that part because we've been building. I mean, Mike's been building this since the 1980s, and I mean, I guess the outside's basically done, but it took us a long time. How about a favorite tool that you like to use? All right, before I forget, because
Are you going to talk about the mushrooms at all?
We can. You know, mushrooms grow very well in our neck of the woods, so to say, because we have so much humidity. And in permaculture, we observe what's growing well, and we work with that energy. So if you're living in an area where mushrooms are growing abundantly, that's a good indicator that there'll be, you know, there's a lot of energy there to work with. So then you can start growing your own shiitakes, your own oyster mushrooms, your own medicinal reishi mushrooms, because you already have the conditions that it'll thrive in. Naturally, and this is outdoors, so I grow on logs outdoors. They become perennial in the sense that I will put them outside. They'll go dormant outside in the wintertime, and they'll produce for more than 3 years. So growing mushrooms, it's one of the chapters in my book where I really simplify it. And really, you could read that chapter and you could start growing mushrooms on your own. Even if you don't live in a high humidity environment, you know, if you just have a space where, you know, there is a little more moisture on your landscape, or you're willing to squirt it with the hose in the shade, you know, by your garden, somewhere where you frequent, really you can kind of create the conditions for growing mushrooms very easily.
What do they do in the winter?
They just go dormant. You know, they'll go dormant. You can leave them outside. As long as they don't dry out, they're fine.
Cool. Okay. How about a favorite tool you like to use? If you had to move and could only take one tool with you, what could you not live without?
Probably a machete.
I was going to ask, is there anything you've had this whole time?
Yeah, I'd say the machete is a tool from living in Latin America, where that usually is the only tool that a farmer will own, literally. I've seen how versatile it can be and how key it is to building, you know, to gardening. It really kind of, you know, fits into, you know, overall survival. So if I had to choose one, it would probably be a machete.
Cool. How about, what's your favorite recipe you like to cook from the garden?
Ooh, from the garden. Gosh, I like to make cocktails from a lot of the things that I grow. I mentioned earlier, I like to make blackcurrant infusions. So I'll take a full quart jar. I'll fill it with freshly picked black currants, and then I'll pour vodka over that, and I'll let it sit for about 4 weeks, 6 weeks, put it in the cupboard in the dark. When I think about it, maybe I'll pull it out and shake it a little bit, and then you pour that off, and it is exquisite. Even by itself, just put it on some ice and drink it, or mix it into other drinks, mix it a little bit of champagne, whatever your thing is. I really like taking these very unique flavors and concentrating them into drinks. That's one of my favorite things.
Cool. I like that. Actually, like, I'm eating to train for this half a marathon or marathon this summer in Missoula that I'm hoping to run. So I haven't had a drink for, it's going to be 5 weeks on Wednesday, but like July 15th, I'm already thinking, like, and I already decided today, if I get injured, I'm having a drink that night, but it's all good.
Yeah. I call it healthy alcohol. I mean, cause it's very medicinal. It really is. Currants have so many good values. And if you think about it, an herbal tincture is, that's how you do it. You soak whatever it is in alcohol, and then you take it. Obviously, you're not taking a whole lot, but, you know, I kind of fudge it and say, all right, well, this is healthy.
I love that. How about a favorite internet resource? Where do you like to go on the web?
Permies.com. Permies.com is a online forum where lots of people are sharing their experience working with all kinds of just very functional growing and building. You know, it's permaculture, but then it also really goes into, you know, everything else. You might even come across it when you Google search something random. Permies will usually come up, and there'll be a thread on Permies where people are talking about what you're interested in. And it's real life stuff. You know, they're not trying to sell you something. They're not angling. They're like, well, look, this is how we tried this unique thing. And this is the problems we had and what works. And you get a lot of people chiming in. So permies.com is a great resource.
Yeah. I think listeners are going to love that, because one of the people who came on my show and talked about permaculture was this woman Kelly Ware, and she's who the one I was talking about that had the swales, and I was like, huh, Kelly, what the heck, but whatever. she can talk for so long. Like, we talk, I think both of her interviews she's done two were 2 hours long each, but my listeners love them. So, and I'm pretty sure she mentioned that permise.com. So I think listeners will like that. And I have a lot of new listeners because we got picked up on the Progressive Radio Network. And I don't think anybody's really talked about permaculture as much as you have. So this is awesome. How about a favorite reading material? Like, is there a book or magazine or blog or website or something you want to recommend?
I really like Lee Reich's book. Lee Reich is a gardener and a fruit grower up in the Hudson Valley of New York. I like his style of writing. It's very entertaining and straightforward, very practical. It's all things that he knows about. One of my favorite books by him is called Uncommon Fruits for Every Garden. And it talks about, you know, the jujube. It talks about the cornelian cherry, the pawpaw. A lot of these fruits that are very easy to grow, but not necessarily commonly known about. So they're not hard to grow exotics. They're very actually easy to grow, but they're just not well known. And reading his stuff really helps you become familiar and comfortable with some of these new easy to grow type fruits. And he has a lot of books. Look him up. He's got a new book coming out soon. But Lee Reich, R-E-I-C-H. So I recommend things by him.
Cool. Oh, I'm so glad. And see, this is where things, I know they go full circle. This is what I was going to ask you was, how do you spell juju beads? Because I was like, is it bees or beads or what's he saying?
Jujube. It's J-U-J-U-B-E. It's in my book. You know, I have a chapter in my book, Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist. I have a chapter in there on uncommon fruits where I talk a little bit about, you know, the pawpaw and the jujube, gooseberries and currants, and a lot of other wonderful characters. Jujube is very well known in Asia and that region. And it's very hearty, very delicious, very medicinal fruit as well. It's also called Chinese date because as it dries and the sugars concentrate, it becomes very sweet like a date, and they are delicious. They have like an apple, caramel, almond flavor to them, and a very, very easy to grow small tree that does not really have disease issues and has beautiful, shiny, glossy leaves. Now, I don't think you're going to get away with growing them in Montana, but, you know, for, you know, probably zone 6, you know, all the way down, potentially zone 10, they're a wonderful tree to work with.
No, but you know who might get away with growing one in Montana is Patty Armbruster. So she's this friend of mine. I'm going to see next week at the Free the Seeds event. And she's got this crazy thing going on the east side where it's super cold. And they have like some kind of underground water source that's heating this greenhouse. And they are growing everything right now in the freezing cold in the middle of Montana. She might be able to get one to grow in that crazy place she's got going over there.
Yeah.
I'm so glad we're talking today. So how about some business advice? Wait, before you say that, let me just say, listeners, you might not hear the interviews I am recording today in order, Friday, February 23rd. But if you don't feel like there is a definite thread going, that somebody out there is encouraging you to open a native plant or native fruit or become the go-to guy in your area that knows about these kind of things going on, I don't know what, because it seems like in the last week or especially today, almost every interview people have been talking about native local landscaping, and today with the fruit tree, with you, with the fruit besides, and just these different things. Like, but anyway, my question is, do you have any business advice to give listeners about how to, like, I don't know, get started in some kind of design? Sure. Like, did you go to design? Like, how'd you get into design?
Just living and doing. I learned a lot from different permaculture teachers. You know, I've gotten inspirations from people like Lee Reich, and just doing it, you know, just kind of, you know, getting enough experience with working with growing and then being creative with it and adapting ideas and really just kind of observing the natural flow on a landscape. You know, if you can sort of tap into where energy is moving, whether that's water, wind, sun, you know, if you work with the energy that's there you'll have huge success. So a lot of it's just kind of tuning in and watching and observing and then working with what I observe rather than taking an idea and running out and just doing it. You know, when you hit the vein of what is already working well, then it thrives. It, you know, really it almost comes back to that design for neglect. If you observe and put things in, you know, where they're naturally going to flourish, the work is a lot less. It's really nice. It just takes a little bit of observation.
Oh, so you hit the nail on the head. I tell people all the time, because Mike and I, since we built our own house and I've dabbled in real estate here and there, people ask questions a lot about building your own home. And I always tell people, if you're going to buy land, like for the first year, you should spend a weekend or a week in a tent on your property for a month or in a camper or something and get to see, where does the sun come up? Where does the sun go down? Where does it come up in the fall? Where does it come up in the spring? You know, really plan your house based on the sun, you know, that solar passive, like the way Mike designed it, our house, so that the sun comes in and heats it in the winter and the kitchen's cooler in the summer on the north side, because you want your kitchen cooler in the summer. I mean, you're going to have your heat going in there in the winter anyway. So just the design and the place where you put your house is, I don't know if you're going to buy raw land anyway.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's a permaculture thing as well, where the idea is that you observe for a year before you do anything. Now that's not always realistic, but the idea is there and it's good because you really won't be getting behind by not starting right away. If you observe and see where things work well, you'll shoot ahead anyway. So you're not really losing time if you take time to observe.
Well said. It's kind of like systems and procedures, you know, it takes a while to get them in place and to document them and figure them out. But once they're there, you can't go wrong. Okay. Go ahead.
No, go ahead. I was just going to say, yeah, it's all about patterns. No matter what we're doing or what it is, whether it's high tech stuff or working on your landscape, it's patterns.
Absolutely. Okay, here's my final question, because you're probably like, oh my gosh, this woman doesn't stop asking questions. If there's one change you would like to see to create a greener world, what would it be? For example, is there a charity organization you're passionate about or project you'd like to see put into action? Like, what do you feel is the most crucial issue facing our planet in regards to the environment, either locally, nationally, or on the global scale?
We need to move back towards perennial agriculture. The more food that we get from perennials, the more carbon we will be able to sequester. So by planting more trees, by planting more woody perennials and bushes, working with perennials in general for our diet, for our building, you know, for all the different needs we have as humans, will sequester more carbon and will be able to lower the greenhouse effect and all the global weirding and weather pattern changing that we're experiencing. It's pretty direct correlation, how we're using our landscapes and, you know, the climate change. And what is on our plate is what the landscape looked like. So we've become a very annual based, you know, culture and diet. So our landscapes are reflecting that. You know, we're turning the soil, which is releasing a lot of the carbon. We're intensively farming the land, releasing a lot of gases. Whereas if we could come back to eating more, you know, nuts, fruits, root crops, and really kind of bring back more perennial agriculture as part of our diet, then the landscape will begin to change. So I think there's a direct correlation there.
Well put. You have totally given us tons of golden seeds. Do you just want to tell listeners how to connect with you?
Yeah. Well, our website, ecologiadesign.com, that's a Portuguese word for ecology. It's ecologia, the word design.com, has a lot of great information on there. A lot of the things from my first book are on there. Our circular straw bale house is on there. Information about pawpaws is on there. I am currently running a Kickstarter campaign until March 25th. And this is to help sponsor the publication of a book all about pawpaws and growing pawpaws and harvesting and using and recipes, really kind of a fun, informative little mini manual about pawpaws. So the Kickstarter really helps me make this a reality. It's kind of like a pre-book order too, because on a Kickstarter, you go on and there's rewards. So you sponsor a project and then you get rewards in return. So it's a wonderful exchange where you support people that are really kind of being creative and starting something on their own. And it gets kind of this extended community support. And then people get to be part of that happening, and then they get rewards from whatever the Kickstarter is. I've got a lot of unique rewards on our Kickstarter page. So it's definitely worth going to look at, even if it's just to see more about pawpaws. So maybe you can put up a link to the Kickstarter. I know our website will also have links to that. So please come check that out and share it, post it on your social media and other places. That's a big support too.
That's what I was going to say. Like, if you haven't gotten like dozens of golden seeds out of our conversation today, I don't know what you were listening to. I just feel like Michael dropped like tons of great information, and, you know, go to his Kickstarter page and, you know, try to pledge something, and definitely share it with your friends and recommend it, and go to Amazon and get his other book because it's such a cool book. And remember, when you go to Amazon, write a review for the book, because that's like super essential. Edible Landscaping with a Permaculture Twist, How to Have Your Yard and Eat It Too. I know you're going to love that book. So listeners, I hope you have enjoyed today's conversation. I know you've enjoyed today's conversation as much as I have, because we do think a lot alike. And I just can't thank you enough, Michael. We've been on the phone for a long time, and I know you're probably tired. It's a long day, and you're 2 hours ahead of me on a Friday afternoon, so I bet you're just ready to go relax and have a nice currant vodka, something infusion or something really good to relax.
And that's right. It's time.
I wish you the best. Thank you so much for sharing with us today, and I will try to get this up. I will put the links as soon as possible, because lots of great stuff there. You really taught us a lot today.
Thank you, Jackie. Thank you for your exuberance as well. It's appreciated.
Yeah. Well, I mean it. I'm totally 100% honest. I wouldn't say it if I didn't mean it. So I'm looking at your website and see the pictures and know the value.
If you know somebody who would benefit from the Organic Gardener podcast, we would just love it if you would share it with a friend. Thanks again for listening, and remember to grow.